the US Civil War, the actual Civil War, was North versus South. You know, generally it was very clear kind of dividing line. And here I think they acknowledge the fact that there isn't really a clear breakdown. And to some degree, this is acknowledged in the fact that it's this fractious kind of fissioning of America. It isn't just once, you know, like Roundheads versus Cavaliers in the context of the English Civil War, you know, Royalists versus Revolutionaries, Reds versus Whites in Russia, North versus South, Confederates versus Unionists in the American Civil War, you know, Communists versus Nationalists in the Chinese Civil War. Those were all civil wars where there was a sharp cleavage and dividing line. And here, I think, the fragmentation is acknowledged in the fact that it makes reference to all these kind of geographical regions.
Your point about breakdown is right. That is what it imagines, and it's different. So one of the ways that like a potential American Civil War is talked about today, like is America coming apart, etc., is this kind of like it's basically Proud Boys shooting at Antifa and vice versa, right? And it's like the forces of order and what the state is kind of relegated to a secondary question, whereas it's very much central in any question of a potential civil war, right? Where's the federal government going to go? Is it going to be split in half, et cetera? What Garland seems to suggest is instead that you might get, for example, the Texan Proud Boys and the Californian Antifa, you know, for the sake of argument, right, actually allying against the federal government. Right, and that there's some sort of generalized breakdown. And I wonder, do you think that's more plausible a picture of what
American Civil War
is? I think it is.
Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history with myself, Alex Hokili, George Hoare, and Philip Cunliffe. Hello.
Hey,
what's up?
So here we're going to merely talk about Civil War rather than reenact it in a podcast setting.
I don't know. I feel like this podcast is always a bit of a civil war with you two guys. Well, but, you know.
What's so civil about war anyway, as Axl Rose once sang?
Yeah, I knew you wanted to get that in there somewhere. The Guns and Roses, as they call
the Guns
them.
And the Roses. Yeah,
very true.
Anyway, so yes, we're going to be talking about Alex Garland's film. But just to tell you a little bit more about BungaCast, bear with me if you know this already. But for new people, or even if you've been with us for a while, we're excited about the changes that we have been bringing in. So I want to tell you a little bit about them and tell you a little bit about how this works, because I think maybe people don't realize, and take this opportunity to tell you. So we release new episodes every single Tuesday. That always happens. And then there's additional episodes which come out most weeks on Thursdays or Fridays. And while two episodes a month will be free, the rest of the episodes in full are only at patreon.com/bungacast. And if you're listening to this, you probably are already a subscriber of some sort. Now, on Patreon, you'll find shows with our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Catherine Liu, Amber Lee Frost, and Lee Phillips. We're still kind of fully bringing them on board, but we're very excited about what we've done with them already so far. And there'll be plenty more to come, of course. We also have episodes on Patreon with writers and editors from Damage Magazine, with whom we're partnered. And plenty of original episodes with the Bunga Boys, that is the three of us you can hear now. And those are episodes on stuff like film, like we're doing today, but also plenty on current affairs and much else besides. And of course, plenty of extended interviews also on Patreon. So subscribers get 4 original exclusive episodes a month that you can't get elsewhere, plus a free subscription to Damage Magazine. It's a nice little bonus there. Now, if you're already subscribed and you've been a subscriber for a long time before March this year, you're probably subscribed to one of the old tiers. And for just $2 a month more, you'll get at least double what you're currently getting or what you have been getting. So have a look at
Alex. Did I hear that? They'll get double what they're getting $2 more.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's like you'd have to snatch my hand off for that deal. Anyway, so have a look at patreon.com/bungacast as the old tiers won't be lasting very much longer. So, you know, if you want to hop over to the new ones, we would be very happy, very, very happy to have you. Okay, so Phil, Civil War, you made us watch this film. You suggested it. I didn't know anything about it. And you're like, oh, we have to be doing this film.
I didn't
so go ahead.
Make you watch it. If only I could make you do anything. Jesus Christ. I suggested that we watch Civil War.
Oh, okay.
Because I think it would be because Alex Garland is maybe not a great director, but certainly an interesting and intelligent director. And I think his stuff is generally worth watching. I was a big fan of Annihilation, the movie that he did with Natalie Portman and Isaacs. I think the other guy's name escapes me. Anyway, the actors aren't so important as the film itself. But also, more importantly, because the theme of this film is about a civil war in America, which was taken as a kind of Hollywood taking the temperature of the nation, as it were, in advance of a presidential election, which is tightening up, as expectedly at this time in this electoral cycle, but also one in which there is so much bitterness as part of the end of history. I mean, it's something we've been talking about for a while, is the new kind of political polarization that has accompanied the end of history. And this seemed like an interesting way of exploring some of those themes in that cultural context. So that was why I suggested, I did not impose the demand that we watch it. I think I certainly benefited from it. And also, you know, I should say also from reading the hot takes about the film as well, which were also instructive and informative in all sorts of ways. And the listeners will find some links to some of the better ones, some of the better reviews we've come across in the show notes that go with this episode. I suppose before we get stuck in, I'd be curious to know, we'll tell you if there's any spoiler alerts coming up, dear listeners and viewers, if you want to avert your gaze or shut your eyes or skip over or whatever. But that aside, before we get into it, did you guys have any, did you have any expectations or hopes prior to watching, apart from obviously the enjoyment that Alex would feel seeing the gringos like collapse into civil war? But also, did you have any, I suppose, any views stemming from previous movies of Alex Garland? I mean, what do you think of him as a director?
Yeah, I mean, so the poster is quite striking. It shows all of these helicopters kind of flying over New York, and the Statue of Liberty's there as well, and it's called Civil War, which kind of, I don't know, that gives you some idea of what it might be about. So I get, but like the British director Ben Wheatley suggests, if you actually think you're going to go and see a film, don't watch the trailer. Don't read anything about it. Try and go in as cold as possible. I do have this beef, and I've probably even mentioned it on this podcast before, about modern trailers. They give away the inciting incident. They give away way, way too much. So I hadn't seen a trailer. I had seen the poster, and I knew the title of the film, which led me to suggest that there would be some scenes of, I don't know, soldiers attacking New York, and that was, I guess, my expectation in terms of the film, in terms of the director. Well, I think some of his films I have enjoyed. He directed Dread, which is a very good with Carl Urban, a very good action film, actually really enjoyable. Ex Machina and Annihilation I thought were fine. Men I thought was terrible. I thought it was really trite and uninteresting. Sorry, Alex Garland, if you're listening. But I guess all of those films, they did have ideas, clearly, you know, and so I was quite optimistic. I'd also seen it after most other people I knew had seen it, and so everyone had said it was good, and I'd said no spoilers. So I'll try and limit my spoilers when we discuss the film. But yeah, I was kind of excited, jazzed to go to go and see some kind of big budget explosions, basically.
What about you, Alex?
I went in not just cold, but frigid, frozen. I knew nothing at all, other than, the commandment I had received from Philip Cunliffe to go watch the film. I didn't know anything. But what's interesting, and I agree with George, as a general point, that trailers give away too much. I have, lots of other people have commented, both reviewers and kind of friends of mine who've seen the film and commented to me, that they were expecting something very different. So the trailer didn't just give away something, but it pointed in a rather different direction to what people were expecting. There, I think the trailer seems to be more crash bang kind of action film. And it's, and we'll talk about this in a second, but it, you know, it opens up much more as a road movie than a war film or an apocalypse film or whatever else, right? So there's like kind of lots of genres going on. And as to Alex Garland, I can't say that I've watched that many of his films, though, you know, it's worth noting, I guess, that he's a writer as well. And so when I listen to him being interviewed about the film, and when someone's a writer, they're far more interesting, I think, than when they're a director. And when they're a director, they're far more interesting than than an actor. That's just a bit of an aside, but I think when in a lot of these interviews, when you hear a director talking about the film, you're expecting them to have this command of the ideas behind it, which exceeds what's on screen. And very often I'm finding myself disappointed where like they're just at most sort of elusive to what the ideas are in the film, and often don't really bring stuff to the fore, because the guy who's holding the ideas really in terms of the world of ideas, of society, of philosophy, of politics, whatever it might be, is often the writer or the screenwriter, and less so the director. So I think it's interesting when, as in this case, it's a film that Alex Garland has written as well as directed.
Well, I mean, directors, it's a visual medium, so you don't necessarily need to, to know the ideas. You just need to make things look good. I mean, I think it is worth just throwing in here. He did write 28 Days Later, which I think is very germane to this, along with The Beach, which you may or may not remember from its All Saints title track, which was quite successful, at least in the UK.
Yeah, oddly, all kind of dystopian in different ways, I think. Even The Beach, which was, kind of a breakout role. Well, one of the breakout roles for Leonardo DiCaprio. And that was, it wasn't directed by Alex Garland. He was the writer for it, just to be clear, the author of the book, and I think also the screenwriter for the film. And it was a very different moment. I mean, if anything was an end of history movie, I think The Beach definitely was, precisely because the whole premise of the premise of the book and the movie, whereas the protagonist, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie, he's missing out on the fact that his generation doesn't have anything. And so he's haunted by all the Vietnam Apocalypse Now soundtrack that takes him backpacking around Southeast Asia, trying to escape the consumerist masses descending on the beautiful beaches of Thailand, looking for this kind of perfect idyll, and kind of generally disillusioned, disenchanted, and adrift in the world. And he finds the perfect kind of, he finds this idyllic hippie commune on the secluded beach in Thailand, and the dystopia, it kind of crumbles apart. It's not quite as, obviously not quite as extreme or as bloody as 28 Days Later, or indeed A Civil War. But nonetheless, there is, I think you can probably say, there is a consistent theme throughout Alex Garland's work. I was very impressed with Annihilation. I think it was very, by no means kind of a perfect movie, but I thought it was tremendously, because it was so evocative. And I think this is, in fact, his great strength. He is evocative. And so even if the ideas are kind of weak, he can convey things through the films that perhaps go beyond his intention or the ideas. So, there was heavy-handed kind of woke feminism in Men, I still think, as George indicated, I think that I presume that's what he was referring to with his distaste for the film. But nonetheless, I thought it was, there were elements of it that were just tremendous and strange and genuinely peculiar and disturbing and uncanny. And so I think he does have a kind of a way to evoke that, perhaps in a way that other directors don't. It's interesting to hear, it's interesting to hear all your views, but I think you can see the progress from the end of history scenario of The Beach to the end of the end of history scenario with the most powerful country in the world disintegrating into civil war in this, in the context of this movie. Just out of interest, are there any kind of comparator dystopian films that you guys would put in a similar league or that you think are perhaps, you know, interesting to mention by way of comparison, or, you know, perhaps perhaps they're better or at least worth kind of talking about in the same breath?
Yeah, it is a good question. I think this film, I mean, we're getting on to talking about, I guess, what it's about to a certain extent, but it's not, I don't think it's really a film about, well, it's hardly an original take. It's not really a film about civil war. So it really reminded me, and I'll go into this in a bit more detail later, but of zombie films in general. That was the vibe. And I can kind of explain why I think that is the case in more detail. But it didn't make me think of other dystopias where I was like, oh, what are the kind of the, what is the dystopian element of this society? You have to, I think, dig quite hard into this film to try and find that out. Maybe some people have suggested it's like there's no media. You have these photojournalists. Who are they reporting to? That's kind of, you know, their societal breakdown. But it's not like, you know, there's been this virus and it's been, you know, unleashed, or there's this kind of alien whatever and that's happened, or this.
Well, it might be worth, I mean, just saying before we, it's a good point. It's an interesting point, George. It might be just worth saying kind of, so the premise of the movie for those, and there's no spoiler alerts yet, but the premise of the movie is some kind of embedded or would be embedded photojournalists, primarily Kirsten Dunst and some kind of tag-alongs, are trying to enter Washington, D.C. in the middle of a civil war in the continental United States as it's besieged by insurgent secessionist forces from various quarters. And they're trying to interview, the kind of the great scoop they want is to interview, to go through the front lines, interview the president in the White House, who's this kind of ridiculous, bombastic, very clearly Trumpian populist figure. They want to get him before the war ends or before DC is overrun by insurgent forces, and they want to get the record. And so it's basically, as George indicated, it's a road movie about these journalists, this kind of peculiar and terrible things that they encounter and that happen to them as they go through the front lines and enter DC. So that's the basic premise. Zombie movie. Yeah, it is kind of a zombie movie. That's kind of right, actually.
I noted down, like, as the, you know, kind of not very long into the film, like how much the vibe of the film was that of a zombie movie, of a post-apocalyptic movie. And I guess if within the broader dystopian genre, or maybe it's a style more than a genre, but, you know, you've got post-apocalyptic and within that you've got zombie. And this was very much that of a lot of quiet, you know, but with a kind of eerie vibe to it, where you have this communication of threat or danger, death kind of around the corner, but which springs up unexpectedly, which is where, you know, the zombie movie gets its kicks from, because it's like, bam, you know, suddenly the zombie jumps out. And there's a lot of that. And actually, you know, the film doesn't do that. Once in a while, there are some moments of, gotcha, you know, suddenly the danger appears, but it's quite, there's that quiet eeriness to it, with something dangerous lurking around the corner. And yeah, that was very 28 Days Later kind of feeling.
Yeah, I think the desolation of the areas that they drive through, there are some really great scenes of like smoking buildings in the background. It's like people aren't there when they should be there. All this kind of classic kind of zombie film. I think if it's a subgenre, those are subgenre tropes. But one which is, I think, important is the family, this kind of found family idea. So you have the main. Mm. The main couple, Kirsten Dunst, is it Wagner or Wagner Moura? He's a Brazilian.
Yeah. Wagner Moura, I believe. Phil just referred to them as tagalongs earlier, and I'm like, this is Brazilian erasure. This is like a Brazilian actor getting like a really big role. Come on.
Represent Brazil. And then you have the daughter and
a very Brazilian name, it has to be said. Yeah, like that is very boys from Brazil, calling the first name of your kid is called Wagner.
And then so you have the daughter and then the grandfather as well, and that is a quite a kind of post-apocalyptic, you know, people coming together to kind of find some a small group and trying to survive in that small group as they make their journey to safety, in a zombie film, but to the president in this film. And I think it is very evocative. I think you said that, Phil, and I think that's absolutely right. There's one scene where there's a downed helicopter in a JCPenney parking lot, and it's just like, it looks, I think it's a film that looks pretty good on the big screen, at least. So yeah, I did have that feeling of like, oh, are they going to be jumped at any point? That is that kind of zombie film.
You see, kind of it's tension. This is actually really interesting, and it didn't occur to me before this, because, like, you know, the zombie apocalypse or the alien, and you know, we've seen the kind of destruction of America so many times, and this was Adam Curtis's point. You know, he's kind of counted the number of times Hollywood directors of one sort or another have imagined, like, you know, New York being swept away by the floods in The Day After Tomorrow, the number of times the White House has been stormed or destroyed or wiped out, or, you know, either in Godzilla or in Independence Day, or, you know, the various asteroid movies. I mean, we've seen kind of America, that was, I think, the classic dystopia of the end of history, and it was a point often made, you know, easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. That was always naturalistic. So you always had kind of this external kind of force, whether it's tidal waves or asteroids or
aliens.
Or aliens, you know, effectively the same thing, I guess, to a greater or lesser extent. Whereas this was novel in as much as its internal disintegration. There's no external force. Now, that said, it's never really, you know, and some people complained about this. I don't know that it's really how you would address it. You know, they complained about the lack of kind of political context and background to the story, which seems to me a bit churlish, because, you know, it's very hard to create a kind of a fictional context like that without making it very boring and also opening yourself up to all sorts of pettifogging criticisms about why didn't you do it like this and why didn't you do it like that. And, you know, I can speak with authority here, given the fact that I've dabbled in counterfactual history.
In your day. Oh, no.
No, I was going to say I've done some counterfactual history in my day.
I know. But what if you hadn't?
A very good book, yeah. Check it out. So, The Name Lives.
Yeah, we've done an episode on it.
We did an episode on it.
I think that's it, right? So it's in terms of like the politics of the film, you could have had this very, I don't know, heavy-handed exposition in the first 2 minutes. And then, you know, this thing happened and California and Texas allied on this thing. And you'd be like, well, that wouldn't happen. And that wouldn't happen. And that wouldn't happen.
Right.
And it would really kind of, I don't know, the veil would be drawn away very quickly. But instead, it's like, this has happened. You get Nick Offerman, who, you know, you might know from as Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, being a kind of dark version of that character, giving some speech. And then it's like you're into it. So
very clearly you can tell from his style, his political kind of style and rhetoric, that he's intended to be a Trumpian style figure from the get go.
A little bit more bitter. Trump is always, you know, kind of clownish. I found him to be more bitter. Well, obviously, you know, maybe he's losing grip on power, but also a little. Yeah. There's something darker than
there is. But also, I think it was meant to be behind the scenes, right? So he's trying to find the right words to express. But it's actually quite well done as a scene. So Nick Offerman's character is the president. I think he's only ever called the president throughout the film, and he's he's kind of trying to find the right words to before he goes on air to kind of deliver the speech, and he builds up the kind of the bombast. And the and layers on the kind of the gratuitous excessive rhetoric the way Trump does. And so the allusion to Trump is meant to be clear at the same time as it's giving away that he's, you know, actually lying and vastly exaggerating the the position of federal government forces against the insurgents. So
indeed, you could say he uses his allusion too. Anyway, so just I wanted to make a point about.
I just wanted to recognize how good a pun that.
That was good, right? I thought it was good. So the one quick point I think about genre again, just before we talk more about the politics. I mean, as I said, it's a road movie. It's a post-apocalyptic movie, which then develops into an action/war movie, and then it might even be another kind of sub-genre, which is might be the profession movie. Certainly, it's like the media movie. I don't know if that's like a qualifying.
Yeah, I think that's actually genre. Quite important. Yeah,
but go on. And it actually progresses through. I mean, to a certain extent, they're simultaneous, and other ones they kind of progress through because the road movie certainly is something that occupies like the first act, more or less, first two acts, and then anyway. So that I thought that was very interesting. I also, in terms of comparisons, other post-apocalyptic movies, what struck me was The Last of Us, which is not a movie, it's a series based on a video game, but which is rather good, I thought. But it, you know, it's in that it's Pedro Pascal accompanying this young girl played by I forgot her name. She has a kind of funny sort of face.
Bella Ramsey,
yes. Yeah. And in this case, it's Wagner Moura and a young girl who's an aspirant, although she's 23, not a teenager. But there's a kind of very similar sort of vibe there between the two and the sort of partnership where they're also, you know, go through a road process of trying to get to freedom or get to where their destination is meant to be. So there's like, it does hit those tropes. And yet I think the fact that it combines these different genres in one makes it a much more interesting movie than if it were just kind of sticking to the language of one of those genres. And I thought, like, as a whole, worth saying, a very impressive movie. Like, I enjoyed it a lot, and I found it very impressive. None of that is to say it's very good. I think it's quite good, but I don't think it's, you know, I just think it's a very impressive movie watching it.
Yeah, just a question on that. Is there a genre of, like, political movie? Because you kind of went through all of those, and that they'll have the genre tropes. Like, are there... But you have biopics, which are like of a political figure. But you do you have like a political movie with certain like genre tropes?
Yeah,
I can't think of that many.
Like Wag the Dog.
There's Carlos. Yeah, I mean, there's Carlos, which is kind of I think it's a political movie with kind of the genre tropes of a thriller.
Yeah, rewatched that recently. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps the Bader-Meinhof complex, perhaps.
But then I guess those are political. You know, those are movement films, and then there are the films of order. You know, the films that follow the political establishment and the behind closed doors. In the Loop, Wag the Dog, often satire. No,
those are satirical. I mean, you've got Il Divo. About what's his face?
You've got Loro.
Yeah, Andreotti.
About Mark Lawrenson, I mean, about Silvio Berlusconi.
Loro, though, that isn't really a political movie. That's about kind of spectacle, I think, whereas Il Divo is more directly kind of about the kind of the political machinations required to run the Italian Republic in the Cold War.
Film is political.
Well, there are many a PhD has been written on that topic. I'm not sure they're all worthwhile.
There's a real kind of sooty point you could make about this. Now that, Phil, you've already introduced the idea of, you know, the end of history apocalypse film and the end of the end of history apocalypse film, that this, because it is not a naturalized phenomenon, you know, natural or naturalized phenomenon which leads to destruction, but it's the internal contradiction in the case of, you know, it being a civil war, that this is the real return of history or the return of politics. Now, I don't think that's the case, but you could make a really wanky point along those lines.
But that's what I was trying to get at, right? I mean, I think the point is, you know, it's kind of gestures in that direction with this kind of fictitious scenario of insurgent forces besieging Washington, D.C. in a civil war that has torn apart the United States. But it's indicated rather than kind of explained or elaborated, and you can't really, you know, it can't do more than that. And so it can't really articulate, you know, much more. And there isn't, you know, I mean, interestingly, right, the breakdown of the conflict, it doesn't seem to me clear that they, you know, it doesn't seem very obviously divided along obvious lines. I mean, occasionally, but not, you know, not consistently. Okay. Right. So I think that's also important because it's always along the road trip, they encounter kind of various soldiers. Sometimes it's clear who they're fighting for. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes they encounter kind of various militias. Again, sometimes it's clear who they're fighting for. Sometimes it's not, whether they're fighting for themselves or, you know, just kind of a local area. So again, it's kind of indicated. It does break with that occasionally, but it does, how shall we say, like...
Yeah, it plays its cards close to its chest.
It plays its cards close to its chest. So I mean, do want to say, before getting into it, there is one of the good themes, I think, in the film is the, and I think that this is perhaps in terms of the intellectual content of the film, is its portrayal of journalism. And this, I thought, was remarkably impressive because it's a very cool portrayal of old-fashioned journalism. And it's interesting that it only works in this totally ludicrous kind of fantastical setting of a civil war in the United States. You know, if you think about the portrayal of journalism in war movies, in contemporary kind of war movies, it's always the journalist in the role of the humanitarian, kind of saving somebody from the conflict to which they've been dispatched in, you know, some kind of godforsaken place in the Middle East or Africa or the Balkans or wherever. And so the humanity, kind of it's the journalist discovering their humanity by leaving their profession behind. Whereas in this case, what's striking is the, and Alex Garland said this in interviews about the film, he said that he wanted to really make the case for journalism in the film. And so you can only be, it seems like you can only be an objective journalist if it's a war in your own country, but not if it's a, if it's a civil war in another country. Mm. So, you know, because it's really striking how consistently, and here there are two, there are, you know, they don't kind of, they maintain their, I think, I mean, they maintain their humanity by their commitment to telling the story. And it's really striking that they do that consistently throughout the film, I think.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I agree. I think you are right that the, you know, if there is much politics in this film, it is about, I think, the politics of journalism and specifically photojournalism. So, like, I think, though, they come across as a bit voyeuristic. I think the commitment to kind of objectivity, like, again, I don't think this is really a spoiler, but you know, one character asked another, like, if, like, would, if I got shot, if I died, would you take a photo of that moment? And the character says, well, what do you think? Yes, I would. And so they do seem, I mean, they're out of place in a
way. That's what they should do.
Yeah, but they're out of place in a way that they're, like, in this American, you know, they're American journalists. They should be in another country witnessing, like, you know, living off the pain of the, of, you know, whatever's going on in this African country. Instead, it's at home. And so I think they see, they come across as very callous and quite, you know, impotent in the sense of, who are they doing all this reportage for? They're doing it for their own thrill seeking. I think that's what comes across. So you see, like, there's a shootout and they're kind of like, they're all like amped up on the adrenaline. They're all like, whoa, that was so amazing. That was so great. And actually, like, what, you know, they take some photos of some people dying. And
but that's what journalists are meant to do. War journalists are meant to take photos of people dying.
Yeah, I mean, but and I think it comes across as a critique.
The thrill, actually. Yeah, they get the thrill, and I think, I mean, that's kind of incorporated into it. Like, you know, they enjoy the. I don't think it's voyeuristic because they're not looking to.
They're not taking themselves.
They're not taking delight in the suffering. They do enjoy the thrill of and the excitement of the danger. I mean, that much is made clear. But they're not, you know, they're committed, I think, to the profession of telling the story.
I think there's a real ambivalence here, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's, and we can question, for example, obviously the I mean, Phil, you've raised this notion. I think it's correct. I mean, and I share the view that independence, objectivity would be the, you know, the aim of the profession. That's what the practice is about. And the more that you stick to that, the better you're doing, right? What's interesting is that my notes on this were kind of went against this, which is that what struck me watching the film initially, and I've kind of revised my view just listening to you guys discuss this, is that, you know, this shows the journalism of attachment, right? This is the Kirsten Dunst is shooting, you know, shooting her camera just like you might be shooting a gun alongside these advanced squads who, you know, here's definitely spoiler alert, they break into the, you know, the White House compound where the president is holed up, and they mesh in with them seamlessly. There's no moment where the journalists have to negotiate with the army press you know, rapport to say, we're going to go in and shoot this with you. Like, they just turn up and start shooting with the shooters. And that, I think.
But that's not the journalism of attachment. That's embedded journalism. A journalism of attachment is telling the story of the poor orphan you know, that's been beleaguered, left alone, turning it into a human interest story rather than capturing aspect of the fighting.
You're right. So, yeah, embedded journalism, I should have said. But, you know, in doing so, they are participating in spectacle. So you might say, yes, they're doing their job. That's what the journalist should be doing. But, of course, should that exist, right? Should that, because what you're doing is participating in the creation of war as spectacle rather than necessarily just purely providing and digging up information.
I think you're mistaken, because the Kirsten Dernst team is precisely contrasted with the embedded team that goes in with the Western, so-called Western forces who are besieging DC. And so they're contrasted with them. And even there's the line where your Brazilian man says, like, these embedded motherfuckers. So, you know, they try to go in alone. They try to penetrate the kind of the lines alone. They arrive under their own steam in DC. And they're the ones who actually lead the soldiers into the White House, because they are the ones who realize that the people leaving the White House was a decoy. So I think it's not so clear that it's, I think the point is they're meant to be independents. And that's partly Kirsten Dunst's character is made out to be a tremendously kind of famous and prestigious war photojournalist. And so it doesn't seem to me like it's about embedded at all.
No, just a couple of points on this. One, I think this scene of them storming the White House is absolutely brilliant. I think it's gripping.
Yeah.
It's like the climax of the film, you know, spoiler alert. But it's, you know, it's another portrayal of the White House falling. And I think it's probably the best one that I've seen on film. I can't think of a better one. But what I would say, or the reason why I think it is more critical, the film is more critical of photojournalism than I think you're saying, Phil, is that, like, they don't, like, who, one of them works in their own description for what's left of, or another character's description maybe, of what's left of the New York Times. And you could ask today, well, what is left of the New York Times? But it's like, they...
I mean, there's already nothing left of it, even without a civil war.
Less than nothing of the New York Times. But they don't seem to be, like, filing any reports. They're doing it for themselves. They kind of, you know, they go to this extremely dangerous place because they have to see it. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that is the truest journalistic impulse. You just have to see it. It doesn't matter if you tell a soul. But that's a bit strange, isn't it? That they speaking with any editors. You never see them sending anything.
Yeah, no, that's true. You make a point. I mean, it's not, you know, kind of a detailed character study of their motivations. And like you say, the kind of the infrastructure of journalism, the back and forth, the editorial process, there are moments of it. Kirsten Dunst kind of going through the apprentices, her kind of little apprentices camera, and identifying good shots. But I think, I mean, you know, that's, I think it's, I think you can say it's, you know, it's a kind of an effective portrayal, because if you want good photojournalists, they have to be, you know, they can't be motivated by humanitarian concern if they're going to get what's happening on camera. And they say that explicitly. They say, you know, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be shooting. We wouldn't be able to record this unless we don't interfere and don't involve ourselves. And at the same time, you have to accept that the kinds of people who do this kind of job are going to be people who are driven by the adrenaline and by the thrill of being in that context.
I mean, famously, you know, in terms of photojournalism, one of the most famous shots is the vulture and the little girl, which is, you know, a starving African child and a vulture kind of looming just behind her. That's from 1993. And that's quite famous as one which prompted loads of questions about should you help the girl? Did you help the girl? What did you do? The photographer interviewed. And it's interesting that in the preparation for this film, Alex Garland suggested to Kirsten Dunst that she watch Under the Wire, about Maria Colvin, a famous, like, Sunday Times photojournalist who I think was famously, you know, involved in kind of the Syrian war, and there were decisions she took as well where she, you know, sacrificed or, you know, put herself in a lot of danger rather than doing the more obvious thing or the more humanitarian thing. So I think there's something which is obviously trying to be explicit about there. And he also does another thing, which is not by this stage of proceedings in post-modernity, isn't that new. But, you know, when we watch action movies or TV news, we don't ask where the camera is. You know, we just take these images as kind of natural representations of what was going on and forgetting that there's someone holding the camera. And what the film does is go, well, actually, let's point the camera at the camera people. And the assault on the White House is great for this because you see the advanced squad who are, you know, going in to kill the president, basically, you know, peeking around corners and shooting. And the journalist does the same, like immediately right after them, shadowing them, poke around the corner and shoot, right? And this shows us a thing where normally we wouldn't ask the question, oh, who's actually holding the camera? Again, there's nothing that novel about this because it's something that's been done a lot. But
on what is the politics of the film? I think the closest, in my opinion, that it comes to a political statement is precisely on journalism, where Kirsten Dunst's character says something like, you know, I thought I was going into all these war zones and sending kind of warnings back home, and it didn't happen. So there is this, like, I accept the point, there's a very violent scene where something's really bad is happening to somebody, and what happens, or what does the character do? They take a photo. They don't step in to help. They kind of let that happen. But ultimately, I think the film is like, well, you know, photojournalists didn't stop this war in the US. You know, they're not really, they're still, they're more like the war journalist in My War Gone By, How I Miss It So, which I think is a book I've referred to on this podcast before, which is about a war journalist who comes back after the war in, I think, in Yugoslavia, and basically gets addicted to heroin because that adrenaline is like so out of this world that you can't replicate it in any other way. So I think it ends up, I would say, on balance, making a kind of a critical like comment. Look at all of these commentators. We're all voyeuristically consuming American decline, you know, and decline of other countries. And, you know, what are we doing about, you know, what impact is our kind of photos or think pieces going to be on this decline? Well, it's not. It doesn't matter.
I'm going to go back perhaps a bit on what I said, I guess, because perhaps the premise of being able to be objective in a civil war in America is the fact that the tyrant is the guy that they're trying to get in touch with, right? So in the sense, the journalism of attachment is redundant because they're the ones who are trying to kind of film the demise of the tyrant. And one of the characters in the movie explicitly compares the president, I think it's the character who plays the journalist tagging along, Stephen McKinley. He compares the president, the Trumpian kind of president, to Ceausescu, Gaddafi, Mussolini, these kinds of lesser, you know, this kind of these lesser kind of more pathetic tyrants than, I suppose, you know, Hitler or Stalin or Mao or whatever. Anyway, so
yeah, and he says they're never very interesting, right? Like, you get there to interview them,
they're always,
like,
yeah, they're always they're always kind of a letdown when you actually get to speak to them, which is odd and many, you know, kind of in a number of levels disappointing, with the implication that, you know, on the one hand it's disappointing, on the other hand there are these kind of more terrible figures who would be less disappointing if you did actually get to speak to them. Anyway, it's only to say, perhaps, you know, there are some elements of the film, the humanitarian intervention, I guess, is, in this case, it is the insurrection against the Trumpian president. That is the kind of the humanitarian intervention in the film. You know, and the Marie Colvin, there's a 2008 movie with Rosamund Pike playing the photojournalist Marie Colvin. It's called The Private War. And it's a decent enough film, but it very much is the journalism of attachment. It's the woman who goes to the civil wars where, you know, it's constantly debated about what the West should do. Should the West do this? Should the West not do that? And registering the kind of the suffering, the human suffering in those conflicts. So anyway, that aside, I want to move on from the journalism thing.
I just wanted to make a point because I think it might work as a nice segue, actually. Like, there is, you know, my I think concluding take, I'm kind of with George on this, that there's an ambivalence there. Garland has mentioned that, you know, his father was a journalist, he respects journalists, so he wants to portray the kind of the nobility of being independent and objective and what the journalists do. But at the same time, he casts a skeptical eye on the notion of spectacle and the way that they're kind of creating, you know, they're part of, you know, what are they doing? Yeah, it's good to go and get these images, but maybe what are you doing going along with this? And so that ambivalence is something which is reflected in the politics of it, where he has plausible deniability on what the politics of each side in the Civil War is. But he tells us in the interview, he's very clear about what this is. This is a fight against fascism, he says. But he says, I know people will read it in different ways, and I'm okay with that because, you know, the California plus Texas is the, you know, or the insurgents. Is that meant to be blue state or is that meant to be red state? We don't know, et cetera.
Yeah, you see, I thought that was quite clever, though, because I thought that precisely to kind of disable straightforward kind of political polarization of California kind of versus middle America.
I thought it was clever, but what would surprise me is that then in the interviews, he's like, yeah, but this is, they're fighting fascism. Basically, it's Trump, the fascist, and that's what they're fighting. But you can read it any way you like.
Yeah, well, no, but that, yeah, that, I mean, you know, that is silly. But the, you know, again, I think, I mean, it's the same. To be honest, I felt the same way about his movie Men. You know, the woke feminism was so kind of crude and obvious, but there were so many elements in it that were interesting and thought-provoking. And I mean, journalism aside, you know, the other elements that I thought were strong was, and the elements that made it, I think, in some ways a convincing and evocative portrayal of actual civil war in any context, it was remarkable how brutal it was, I thought, in the sense that you constantly see, so even the people who are supposed to be fighting the fascists, the good guys, in this case, the so-called Western forces, the Californians who are storming the East Coast, you know, you have unarmed and surrendering people being massacred or shot in cold blood. Lots of clips of obscure militias, you know, dealing out random violence. Soldiers where it's unclear who they're fighting for and they don't really care themselves, that they're only kind of trying to kill the people who have them, who are trying to kill them, who are pilled down, as well as the pockets of, you know, on the road trip, they encounter these kind of pockets of urbane, well-to-do middle America, among all the chaos, which is, and it's never really explained how these little pockets of urbanity manage to survive alongside the front lines, though it's indicated there is some kind of, you know, deal or some kind of protection behind the scenes. And I thought all of that, you know, if you strip away the kind of the layer of the scenario, if you strip away the layer, that I think is a very, you know, those kind of elements I think would be familiar to any civil war over the last 200 years. The confusion of the factions, the indiscriminate brutality, the, you know, allied militias, the desperation, all of that, I think. And I thought that was captured extraordinarily well.
Yeah, I'm going to basically choose to disregard Alex Garland's idea that this is against the fascists, because it actually makes the film worse, I think.
Yeah.
Because it takes away from all the things that you were highlighting there, Phil, that this idea of like confusion and implosion and like just, yeah, brutality and arbitrary violence and all these sorts of things, I think that was captured well. And that's, you know, some of the points I made earlier about the zombie film, that kind of, you know, there's arbitrary violence lurking around the corner. I think that was one of the most evocative bits of the film. I guess in terms of, you know, seeing, or what was this one of the scenes that really stands out in this kind of, you know, if there was a civil war, how would it actually be? Is, you know, we can't go through the whole episode without talking about Jesse Plemons and his sunglasses. If you haven't seen the film, it's worth the price of admission just for these red sunglasses. So yeah, there's a very,
you can always be relied upon to do the kind of sociopathic creepy killer.
He's actually a really nice guy in real life, apparently. I don't know. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just a method actor. But yeah, so it's interesting. I'm trying to think of a way to say this without kind of spoiling it. But apparently when that scene finishes, with a kind of an intervention from the grandpa of the group, if that's, you know, if you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. So apparently this was very divisive. So some audiences in South by Southwest when the film was released were cheering at that point. Some were just in stunned silence. But what precedes that kind of, you know, what kind of American are you? So
Jesse Plemons interrogates the journalists, demanding to know what kind of American are they, while he's kind of overseeing the dispersal of a massacre of civilians, it looks like.
And it's unclear what the right or wrong answer there is, other than being non-American, in which case that's the wrong answer because those people get killed.
Yeah, well, he says, are you a Central American or a South American?
Brazil doesn't cut it.
But he kills the Hong Konger from, and he's like, oh, China?
He kills the Hong Konger. But then, you know, he leaves it open. So Kirsten Dunst, I think she says Colorado. So presumably Colorado is allied with the federal government. And so if he leaves her alone, he turns to your Brazilian man and he says he's from Florida. Florida, the Florida Alliance is one of the kind of insurgent breakaway blocks from the Union in the movie. And he's also very clearly Latino with his accent and his look. And so he kind of leaves him for a moment. But the implication is that this is the moment, particularly given that you know, Jesse Plemons has that kind of blonde, corn-fed look, you know, kind of white European origin, but, you know, doesn't look European, somehow looks that kind of weird mix of Irish, German that you only get in America. And he's very clearly kind of meant to be the Midwestern kind of redneck fascist, you know, Michigan militia kind of Trump voting type, right? That's the closest you get in the movie to the invocation of the bad guy aside from the president himself.
But it's done in a way where it's not like this is it's unclear. And I think
there's
that's
always plausible deniability, right? So there's another moment which I think lots of people have commented on, which is they say that the Kirsten Dunst character got famous photographing the Antifa massacre. Right. And it's just left like that. And it's like, oh, is that the Antifa killing doing a massacre or being
That's
massacred?
Exactly what I
we don't
thought.
Know.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know.
You know, like it could just be either one. Right. And then there's a reference to Portland Maoists. Right. What did they do? You know, that doesn't sound not just pulling down some statues, I think, in the context of the movie.
No, but I think it is important not to have it all spelt out for the viewer, because then you can pull whatever your particular political position is into it. But more importantly than that, you can imagine that it would be that, like, every interaction that you have is a bit like, oh, if they don't have the colors of the side that they're fighting for on them at that point in time, you're instantly in like, oh, actually, I just kind of give a vague answer where I'm on the same side as you, mate, or sort of that sort of thing. So I think it does, the polarization in terms of the Civil War, that is, I think it is well represented through this kind of, oh, well, somebody else has got more guns than us and don't really know what their particular views are. It's more about disintegration than mobilization in two clear sides, A versus B.
Yeah, and that I think was kind of important, actually, because, you know, the class, I mean, obviously, you know, the US Civil War, the actual Civil War, was North versus South, you know, with the exception of, you know, kind of a few states whose, you know, kind of who were slave states who kind of cleaved to the Union. Generally, it was very clear kind of dividing line. And here, I think they acknowledge the fact that there isn't really a clear breakdown. And to some degree, this is acknowledged in the fact that it's this fractious kind of fissioning of America. It isn't just once, you know, like Roundheads versus Cavaliers in the context of the English Civil War, you know, Royalists versus Revolutionaries, Reds versus Whites in Russia, North versus South, Confederates versus Unionists in the American Civil War, you know, Communists versus Nationalists in the Chinese Civil War. Those were all civil wars where there was a sharp cleavage and dividing line. And here, I think, the fragmentation is acknowledged in the fact that it makes reference to all these kind of geographical regions. So you've got the Florida Alliance, you've got the Western Forces, that's presumably California.
Well, it's California and Texas, right? I think that's what the
assumption is. Yeah, but Texas is a separate state, was my understanding, which is allied with the Californians. So it's an independent. My understanding was that it's an independent.
I understood the alliance in question was Texas plus California, which is, again,
well, it shows how open it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, indeed, right? But then it kind of makes sense as well, because even though Texas wouldn't, you know, like, even though Texas would be a red state in this context, you can also imagine them kind of making a break for independence in the context of America, you know, kind of the Union kind of falling apart.
Your point about breakdown is right. That is what it imagines, and it's different. So one of the ways that, like, a potential American Civil War is talked about today, like, is America coming apart, etc., is this kind of like, it's basically Proud Boys shooting at Antifa and vice versa, right? And it's like the forces of order and what the state is kind of relegated to a secondary question, whereas it's very much central in any question of a potential civil war, right? Like, where's the federal government going to go? Is it going to be split in half, etc.? And because of the depoliticized and culturalized way that these things are talked about nowadays, it's just seen as, you know, Antifa versus Proud Boys, and that's like the that's what the civil war is, right? Forgetting about the state. And what Garland seems to suggest is instead that you might get, for example, the Texan Proud Boys and the Californian Antifa, you know, for the sake of argument, right, actually allying against the federal government, right, and that there's some sort of generalized breakdown. And I wonder, do you think that's more plausible, a picture of what
American Civil War is? I think it is. I think what the film gets right is that it would, like, an American Civil War, as unlikely as that seems, thankfully, you might say, would be forces of succession. Secession and destruction, rather than these two kind of really opposed camps. It would be who has the ability to mobilize around subtracting themselves from the US rather than taking over. It seems like in the film, the Western forces would go and take DC in order to decisively leave the US and fracture it up and balkanize it, rather than in, like, the Man in the High Castle, a kind of fascist ruling over the whole of the US. No, it doesn't. That seems very, very much more
unlikely. Or indeed, so I think, the unified revolutionary forces trying to take on the federal government. Yeah,
trying to establish a new constitutional order. So, no, I mean, to that extent, I think that's what they're trying to get at. I mean, as listeners, viewers will see in the show notes to the episode, a link to Michael Lind's critique of it, where he makes, the very apposite point. He says that there is, he poo-poos the idea of civil war as a likely prospect, but he makes the more interesting point, which is that there is no clear geographical division within the US around which you would hinge a war. Rather, the division runs within each state themselves, between the kind of urban core, where you have the kind of metropolitan elites, and the exurban, suburban kind of sprawl, where you have working class, essentially. And then you have, obviously, kind of centers of oligarchy on the east and west coasts. And so he makes the point that if you did have this, violence on that scale, it would be within the major urban areas, divided between the kind of metropolitan areas and the working class districts, essentially. And it would be a civil war that would end very quick, because quickly the people kind of hold up in the metropolitan cores would realize that once their kind of nannies and janitors and cleaners and waiters and various kind of lackeys and servants go, that they're completely helpless and isolated and have nobody to kind of defend them. So anyway, that's a segue or a pivot, I guess, I think we've been generous enough to Alex Garland in the film. And I think it's worth now identifying some of the weaker parts of the film. Some of it, I'm still wondering what is being conveyed by it. So there is one moment where there is kind of a very obvious, the voice of liberal Hollywood, when the journalists are in the car and they're running through the possible questions that they would ask the president, the Trumpian president, when they got there. And the grandpa of the group says, one of the questions he would put to him if he had the chance would be, was it a good idea to dissolve the FBI? with the implication being that, such a thing is so kind of obviously absurd and ridiculous. And I just thought, so that was definitely, it's probably Alex Garland's thought, but also, that's the voice of liberal Hollywood talking through that character. And striking, because, any normal person would think dissolving the American secret police would be a good idea.
I'm not sure everybody would.
I said every sane person, right? Obviously, deranged PMCers wouldn't, right? But a sane person would think dissolving the American secret police would be a good idea. But anyway, that aside, think for a moment, right? Liberal Hollywood, right? Persecuted by the deep state for decades for all being kind of commies and Jews and queers by the FBI, literally by J. Edgar Hoover. Now, think that the FBI is their friends and think like dissolving the FBI would be the height of kind of fascistic irresponsibility. That's right. Really quite a turnaround. No, and, you know?
But there's a little echo there. I'm pretty sure it's deliberate, is that disbanding the FBI is Bush's dismantling of the Ba'athist state as well, right? The obvious error that you make in policy, right? That's like the big policy error that is in, you know, living recent memory. I think that's what it's kind of a callback to as well. Though I totally agree with your take that it's basically saying, you know, obviously it's stupid to disband the FBI, where of course it's very much the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just choose to kind of disregard that. You have to assume in any Hollywood film there's going to be some. You will enjoy it more if you just
you can disregard it for the benefit of preserving your enjoyment of the film, and it didn't take away my enjoyment of the film. And that, you know, I mean, that was crude and obvious. There were other things which are, I think, kind of odd and less obvious, or maybe just that, you know, the kind of the screenplay is just more degenerate than I'm willing to admit because I am attached to the film. But for instance, when the Californium, the Western Alliance, the Western Forces, whatever they're called, when they storm the White House and they blow up the Lincoln Memorial with a bazooka, I was trying to work out what are they trying to say here? Is this like the Hollywood revenge fantasy on Washington? Is it that they also hate Lincoln, you know, that the emancipator, the way, you know, kind of Antifa pulling down statues of Lincoln and Grant during the BLM riots, you know, is that the thought? Is it that the Civil War is so horrible and destructive that we end up destroying even our great monuments? Is it that Lincoln is just a kind of a Republican, you know, the Lincoln Memorial is just a kind of a Republican, you know, something that now belongs to Trump and therefore we have to destroy it? I was really struck by, that seems to me quite, you know, that's kind of ratcheting up. You know, you can have kind of the aliens destroying the White House on Independence Day. You can have the white, you can have the Statue of Liberty kind of, you know, being kind of, not quite drowned, but, you know, the waves kind of rising to the midriff of the Statue of Liberty or whatever. But the thought of literally blowing up the Lincoln Memorial, you know, that is, I thought, that's quite a statement on the part of the director.
So that moment really struck me as well. And I was like, wow. But then my conclusion was, well, there's so many different there's so many things here that point in different directions as to the politics of the film, that it's more of a dissembly, or, you know, kind of distract, you know, it's not meant to communicate a clear idea. It's meant to just be like, well, this is what happens in this world and things point in various different directions.
Maybe. What did you think, George? Maybe. I mean, maybe you didn't think it was so important.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know. It's so obviously they're kind of encroaching, getting closer and closer to the White House, and the tension is ratcheting up. And I guess I just kind of saw it as like, well, they're not going to blow up the White House. Well, they might do, but I don't. We've seen enough of this film to think that that's not likely to happen. So you have to have a secondary sacrifice. You have to have some somewhere in Washington that's going to get destroyed. And maybe, I don't know. There's a definite psycho, you know, COD psychoanalysis kind of take you can have on this film, which is like, why is it that so many filmmakers, so many of those people in Hollywood want to see Washington taken down a peg? They want to see the White House stormed. They want to see the president killed or captured or whatever. So maybe there is something in that. It didn't look that real. I mean, that scene, I think it looked too CGI for me. So I was like, oh, they're doing it because people recognize that monument.
Maybe. I thought it was well done.
Happened.
So, I mean, I thought it was curious that, and it left me unsatisfied. The fact,
I mean,
that
you don't actually see Abraham Lincoln blown up. You just see the monument, kind of the outside portico of the monument being blown up.
But I mean, soon after that, you know, as they break into the White House, they discover that the president is holed up in there. They kill the press secretary who's been sent out to negotiate, and they actually just kill her stone dead. They go in and they kill the president, pretty much immediately, right? So they've got the president kind of on his own there. And they could ask him further questions. They don't ask him any questions. In fact, Wagner Mora's character actually all says, "Can I get a quote?" Right, and the president says, "Don't kill me." And
spoiler alert. Goes,
yeah, well, yeah. I think by this point, the listener will have gotten on to that. We go. They go, "Yeah, don't kill me." The president says, and the And Wagner Moura goes, yep, that'll do. That's perfect. And it's like, really? Is that what you've gone in there for? Like, and does the opposition alliance, the insurgents, not want to try the president? Do they not want to make a spectacle of killing him? No, they don't do any of that. And I'm like,
yeah,
well.
But they said they were going to kill him, right? Before they go in, the soldiers tell the journalists that that's their intention. But I thought also that was a good moment of old fashioned journalism as well. You know, he says, don't let them kill me. The journalist doesn't intervene. And he says, you know, that'll do. It's the final words of the guy. You know, I'm not going to get a chance to do a full interview. Fine, it'll do.
Can I get a quote is just so tokenistic, right? He doesn't ask him a question. Can I get a quote? As if it's like, you know, someone leaving a courthouse. Can I get a quote? Like, I'm not guilty, yeah. Whatever. You know?
I thought it was a very effective summing up.
I'm not sure I agree. I think it was trite, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been. What I was worried was he was going to be like, why did you do it? And then he was going to say, because I hate democracy and I hate America, or for my own personal gain, I'm sorry. And then they would have shot him. But instead it was just like, oh, so it's kind of paying off that kind of Ceausescu kind of comparison earlier, rather than being like, Trump is bad. And I was like, well, at least, you know, that I guess that's my kind of political requirement of a film, is like, don't just be like, everyone's a fascist and Trump is bad.
The wish fulfillment point that you made, George, right? Like, what would the wish? I don't think it's wish fulfillment, because there's no real great payoff. If you wanted a wish fulfillment thing where the Trump figure gets, you know, you'd have him hanging upside down or whatever.
Well, but I think that's partly also this maybe the success of the film, right? It is a letdown, you know, in the end, like it is a letdown. And I think, I mean, you know, because it's such a kind of compelling portrayal of the attack on DC, who would be the most natural kind of people who would think about an attack on DC would be Trumpians, right? Drain the swamp, kind of take down the federal government, destroy the administrative state. So I think, you know, kind of if you're watching it, you know, the kind of the idea of an attack on DC and destroying all the kind of monuments in DC, maybe not the Lincoln Memorial, but, you know, taking it all down, that's the kind of the insurrectionist instinct of, you know, kind of the Trumpians rallying against the deep state. So there's all sorts of vicarious, I think, layers, and it kind of plays to the different aspects, I think, of the audience, but at the same time plays to the liberal fantasy. And the Trumpian president then is assassinated by a Californian black woman, which would be kind of every, you know, kind of anti-fa liberal left fantasy played out there. So I suppose I wanted to finish up by, I suppose we've talked around it, but it's worth just posing the question. Not that I want answers from my two resident insurrectionists, but only to leave the viewer with the thought or the question. I'm still wondering what is supposed to be evoked in the viewer. And I think there are these multiple elements, and I think there must be some satisfaction for many people watching it. So, you know, the Death to America crowd will, you know, they will enjoy some of that elements. I imagine even a Trumpy rioter might enjoy some of the attack on DC, even if it's kind of intended against a Trumpy president. I think any country where this movie is shown, where the US has bankrolled kind of Contras or death squads or KLAs or jihadis to pursue a civil war, I think anyone in those countries will probably enjoy seeing the Americans get a taste of what they've been doling out to other countries throughout the world. But I think anyone who also hates the feds or thinks DC is a fetid swamp, you know, they might also enjoy the scene of Washington, DC being taken down.
So I was going to ask you as well. I mean, I was going to ask you guys what, you know, what you felt like when you came out of the film. Like, as soon as, you know, the credits roll, you stand up and you walk out of the cinema. Like, without kind of intellectualizing or trying to rationalize too much, like how you're feeling, just immediately how you felt. What was your, you know?
Yeah, it is a good question. I don't think I had a really emotional reaction to this film. I was hungry. I mean, that's a bit contingent.
That is fair. An emotional reaction for an Englishman, for a emotionally constipated Englishman, George.
No, but I didn't feel like the killing of the president, again, spoiler alert, I didn't feel like that was some moment of catharsis. I didn't feel like it was a triumph of good. I didn't feel it like tragic ending. It was just like, you know, a resolution. And I think in some ways that is a good thing. that it didn't try to be like, oh, look at this tragic resolution, or look at this like great hopeful like note. It was just like, oh yeah, and then this guy dies, and it's like, yeah, they take a photo, and then you can go and get some KFC if you want to, if you're a cinema goer.
There might not be any KFC. Might all be kind of, you know, you'll have to pay for it in Canadian dollars because the greenback is now worthless, apparently, in the context of the
Canadian
film.
Boiled chicken or whatever. Yeah.
So I want to finish up. How did you feel?
No, how did you feel?
I was surprised. So I expected to go in hating the film from top to bottom, and I was surprised again. I mean, Alex Garland kind of surprises me, I guess, because he manages to, he can put enough of a scene together, and he can kind of capture enough nuances that he keeps you engaged and surprised with the way he plays certain things out. So, you know, I was kind of, I was glad, I suppose. I left being glad that it wasn't an entirely wasted couple of hours.
So I walked out feeling like these are important times, and it is important to be serious. Like that was without reflecting on it.
Really?
I walked out and I was like, these are serious times, you know,
really?
Kind of like, and walked out kind of like walking quite straight up and like, no, don't talk to me. I have things to do.
I live in serious times. You know, I need to go and do my podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But like, that was what it felt like. And obviously wore off within, you know, a minute and a half. I went for a piss and then it was like, yeah, okay, that's worn off now, you know, back into real life. But like, I was absorbed enough by the film and it made me feel like these are serious times. And maybe that's what, you know, that's probably what he was trying to do. Like saying, you know, pay attention. These are serious times.
So, I mean, we have to end the discussion, I think, by discussing the geopolitics of the film. And more importantly, whose side would you take? So in the film, as far as I've been able to read it, you have a continental US that's divided up between the United States, the federal government, which is dominated by this Trumpy president. You've got the Western forces, California, you've allied with Texas, according to Alex. You've got the so-called Florida Alliance, I think, which is presumably like a breakaway Latino Southern kind of state thing. And Alaska's mentioned at one point as the...
There's a map on the Wikipedia page. And it has the Florida Alliance basically being the Deep South, stretching all the way to Oklahoma, but who are also with the insurgents, I think. So
they are, yeah.
Yeah. And so like basically.
And you've got Alaska as a neutral territory because at the end, the president is trying to negotiate to flee to Alaska.
Well, apparently it's loyalist. Apparently it's loyal, according to this map on Wikipedia. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, so which side would you choose? I'm guessing, Alex, you would go with the Florida Alliance because it's the home of the Latino core of the U.S.
The worst Latinos. Like you've got to choose.
You've got to choose. No, I think that's exaggerated about Florida anyway, but you can choose. Do you choose Texas, California, the Western forces, the Florida Alliance, or the United States?
I'm taking the Western Alliance. Just, you know, we need change. I'm just voting for the change candidate, the change forces. Beat him in.
Who would you go for, George?
I think I would stay true to the Commonwealth, and I would be on Canada's side because apparently their money is very valuable in this new America. So
good. That is actually a very good choice. I think I would have no choice but to side to stick for the dying United States. I would defend it. Perhaps as I'm the one who has to defend lost causes on the podcast. So George would go for the stable currency. Alex goes for the Californians because even though he's Latino, quasi-Latino, hates Florida so much, he has to go for California instead.
No.
Only I am left to defend the vision of the United States.
We're talking about geopolitics, actually. This is one thing that did occur to me in the film, that if the U.S. were to break down in this manner and into civil war, there'd be so many foreign forces which would flow in, right, to take advantage.
Where from?
The Chinese would surely invade in some way.
They can barely get amphibious forces onto Taiwan, let alone invade across the Pacific. Where are they going to come from?
In a U.S. in chaos and division, I'm sure there would be,
maybe it's time for the rebooted British Empire to seize the opportunity.
Yeah, where? With who? With what forces? I think that's the element of it, it's a ludicrous scenario, but you know, as we said, but I think that's the other aspect of it. I think the world would probably let it fall, you know, where it would. I don't think, you know, I mean, the rest of the world would struggle to involve themselves just in terms of getting troops on the ground. It would be impossible.
Surely the EU would. You know, I can't see that there would be any way that it wouldn't become a world war. I mean, this is why I don't think you want to think too hard about the actual politics of it.
It might become a world war, but it wouldn't be a world war fought in America. That's the point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but they don't really, I think, again, wisely, don't really talk about what's happening in the rest of the world. Like, has this spread to Europe? Has it spread out like wider, as I'm sure it would?
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of to its credit, because the more you get mired in what would actually happen, the more you, as I said at the top of the show, it would just be like, that's ridiculous.
That's a fantasy. That's the big fantasy that it rests on, of a kind of isolationist, isolated America where it can have its civil war play out, but would kind of somehow untouched by the rest of the world.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think I mean, you can play this, you know, too many ways, I guess. I was just thinking also, kind of, there is a Red Dawn, kind of a reminder of Red Dawn, the original movie. Because there, it's the Nicaraguan-Cuban-Soviet invasion of the continental U.S., but there is no lead-up. It just happens, you know, kind of, it's an ordinary day in an American high school in the Midwest, and then suddenly there are communist paratroopers landing in the fields outside. And it's a similar kind of thing with this, you know, it just begins. There is no kind of real background, you know, it just begins with the premise, the America's in civil war. Roll with it. Anyway, I think we've probably given Alex Garland more than his due in the discussion, but I'm sure our listeners and viewers, I'm sure you'll have many of your own views about it. We'd be very interested to hear them, so do ping us either on Patreon or on social media, wherever you prefer. Let us know and give us your feedback, and I have a feeling we will probably return to this either in our next AfriBonus bonus episode, or maybe just in general follow-up discussions that we have over the course of the rest of the year.
Yeah, so we'll look forward to your comments. Also, let us know if there's some film that you think we should discuss, some kind of political film, however you want to conceive of that, or if you believe that all films are political. Maybe we'll just do all the films. All right, that's it from us for now. Catch you next time. Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye.